be advised.
Spoiler alert episode. Spoiler.
Please be advised. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler up 98. Once upon a time in Hollywood.
So close to that 100 mark.
We're getting
hit it soon.
We're going to get it soon. And so, folks, this is a spoiler up. This is a Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. If you're new to the spoiler ups, we're going to talk about the most aspects of the movie, including the ending. So if you've not seen this movie, this is not for you to listen to. Hit the pause button. Go.
Come back later.
Come back at least 3 hours later. and then you can listen to this movie.
So, all right.
All right. We talked about this in the regular episode. You guys liked it. Mike liked it more.
Mm-hmm.
I did not.
I've only seen it once.
There's a lot of aspects to it that I did like, and I'll go into the things that I liked.
Mike has seen it twice, going on three.
Going on three.
Yeah, times. I'll be going tonight to see it a third time.
For me, when we got to the ending, and I was like, really?
Yes.
I waited around for 2 hours and 40 minutes to just not have them, so it was his fantasy of them not getting murdered. I was like, okay. I didn't need to do this.
Let me ask you this, like, from a historical perspective. I don't know all the details of the Manson murders and all of those things. Like, was Quentin Tarantino trying to say, all right, this was the first attempt at the murders? Like, these members of the commune, they tried to do the murders, they failed. Then it's almost like another team went out and committed the murders that then we know about in history.
This is an alternate
universe.
This is an alternate universe. Okay.
No, because their big gun was in this. He was on the team. He winds up getting... this was not a fledgling effort. Tex is there, which indicates to you that this is the real family. This is them.
Okay. Tex is the guy that was in part of the real...
Yes.
Right.
Tex is... He was the main guy in the Manson family besides... Manson.
So we're looking at an alternate reality, alternate universe, alternate outcome of historical events.
Yep. I'm going to give you a word, and I think you'll make the connection right away when I say this. He made a fable.
Okay.
About the Manson murders.
Okay.
That's what he made. He made certainly alternate ending, however you want to phrase it, but just the very title alone, the very ending with that nice little piece of music from Judge Roy Bean, and then the aerial shot of... Oh, look, everybody's okay and everything's fine. Mm. He made a violent fable.
Right.
And with a different ending from what happened in real life.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I like to look at it.
Interesting. Okay. So one of the things as I was watching this movie is that, because I knew that these would eventually be referenced, these Manson family murders, because it was in the trailer and we saw, you know.
And he references Shannon's the actual date. So,
yes.
So August 9th, 1969, 4 days after I was born, by the way. This is when those actual murders happened.
Yes. And I remember
the murders were committed by Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, who brought a knife and drove to and from the murder but did not directly participate in the killing, and Patricia...
And she was probably the one that bailed then and drove away with the car. Because I remember in the middle of this film watching it, and I'm thinking just it's, you know, a lot of Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio just kind of having some dialogue back and forth. This is the least violent Tarantino movie I've ever seen. And then surely that's going to change. And sure enough, at the end, we have this vastly graphic, you know, murder scenes that
relentlessly
graphic. And excuse me, what I was thinking is that they were so brutal and they were so graphic that I can't imagine, like, I guess that's why you said people were laughing, like, because it was so over the top. It was almost like satirical violence. But I thought that the movie was so grounded that I found that violence all the more horrifying at the end than I did satirical or funny. So I did not get that reaction at all.
Well, I think it's a real unexpected moment for people. Like, I will say this. I wish as a viewer, he would have done a better job of camouflaging them going into Rick Dalton's house. Because when he said to Susan, he's like, go around the back and see if there's a door. She clearly goes around the back of DiCaprio's house. If they would have approached the gate, it would have been framed differently, we would have seen them in front of the gate for the Tate house. Oh, by the way, if you don't know what happens, all right, in the movie, spoiler alert, as you all know, it's a spoiler episode. The Manson family shows up on Cielo Drive and they break into the wrong house in this movie. And instead of killing Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring and Wojtek Frykowski and Folger, they wind up dealing with Brad Pitt. And they wind up dealing with Leonardo DiCaprio. So they break into their house instead of...
And the dog.
Right. Certainly.
And so Brad Pitt is just... is who's been established. And again, I like Brad Pitt's character. I love the little filmmaking things of... He's a stuntman, so there's these scars. Yep. His body has been banged up, man. I love that they... He apparently killed his wife, and they just do that, and he's on the scuba boat, and she's just, I don't know if that's like
a... Well, we don't know if he killed his wife. He could have hit a choppy wave, and the spear gun could have gone off.
Right.
We never see it happen.
You never see it happen.
Because right now, that is a huge contentious thing with the people who don't like the movie.
Right.
As I said, they're viewing it through the prism of 2019. They go, oh, we just make a movie now where a guy kills his wife, and he's a hero, and it's funny. And I'm like, no, we just make a movie.
Yeah.
That's all.
I didn't have a problem with
that. I certainly didn't see him as a hero.
But I'm just talking about like the wave of we talked in the initial episode. You said there are people who fucking love it and there are people who fucking hate
it.
Exactly. The people who hate it are all, I think, viewing it through the prism of now, that sort of thing.
I totally agree with that.
Which is a problem with a lot of art right now.
Yeah. You got to take art for, you can't impose all of these artificial viewpoints onto art. You have to let art speak for itself and then judge it on its own merits. You can't just add all of these external things to it and judge it from, you know, your perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the depiction of, you know, I kept trying to go, like, who is Leonardo DiCaprio supposed to be? Like, which actual hero, like, TV star is he modeled after?
Oh, well, from what I've heard... DiCaprio is Burt Reynolds and Cliff Booth is Hal Needham.
Mm. Oh, interesting.
So that is who, you know, because Tarantino was super close to Hal Needham. He actually gave Hal Needham, I forget, it was a Lifetime Achievement Award. I forget what the function was, but he was very close with Hal Needham.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people feel that this is his viewing of, you know, because Burt Reynolds was on television and stuff. And some people they thought it was Eastwood because of the spaghetti Western thing, but because, and also he was on a Western, he's on Rawhide, and then he wound up making the spaghetti.
That's
Westerns.
What I thought too, because I was like, that. So, yeah. That's
the two different interpretations.
Well, it's really interesting now as we're talking about how all of this is kind of coming together, where every single part of this film, from the characters to the real life counterparts, is skewed in a slightly different way. Especially now with the ending, it makes a little more sense.
Uh huh.
Because, like, you know, the portrayals of not only like Steve McQueen, the Playboy Mansion, and Bruce Lee. They looked just like these people. It was almost
the off-putting. Bruce Lee guy sounded exactly like Bruce Lee.
Yeah, I'm like, oh my God. Like, at first you're thinking, well, is this some kind of CG weird hologram thing?
And that's the first part of the movie that sings. Mm. That's the first part of the movie where you feel crackling excitement within the film. I mean, certainly in the beginning, we get a lot of the Bonnie Law. We get him driving and all those things. But when Cliff gets the job and we get that little cutaway to, you know, because it's Pitt's up, you know, initially Pitt takes his shirt up, he's up there. And by the way, it's funny that McQueen is in this movie and he's only in it for like fucking 20 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Because this, Cliff Booth, that's the role McQueen plays in this movie if they make it in 1969.
Right, I mean,
that's,
absolutely.
It's the McQueen role. It's phenomenal. And when Pitt has the flashback to when he meets Kurt Russell and is he going to give him the job on the Green Hornet? And then they kills his wife, and there's the flashback within the flashback.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's and so that sequence there, that's Tarantino, buddy. That is the fucking on the set when Pitt drinking milk and then says, hey, I thought that was shit with some shit you dancers came up with so you wouldn't have to fucking be in a real fight. I mean, oh, dude, the whole, even because we all know who Bruce Lee is.
Right.
So the whole theater, when I saw it, they all just like, it's this palpable thing. It's great. And then I feel like you, because you were saying that Bruce Lee gets his ass kicked.
Yeah.
I think he doesn't take Cliff Booth seriously at all. And when he knocks him down with a flying kick, he's just like, this guy's a fucking joke. And that's why he's like, all right, Cato, try that again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then he tries the same flying kick, like, whatever, dude.
Well, the thing that was great about that scene was he said, I'll beat you two out of three times. They only did two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He got knocked down once. Bruce Lee got thrown into a car.
Yeah.
And I love when he threw him into the car and dented it. I was like, oh!
It's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, another great, again, because Brad Pitt is just phenomenal. He's never mad.
No.
That scene. To him, it's fun. He's like, this is all right. When he throws him into the way, I think that dent in the cars is a whole other fucking story. Just like, it's just genius. He's relishing every moment of it.
If you're Cliff a Booth. Stuntman and that's your life, of course you'd be loving every minute of that. Absolutely. You know, you live for a tussle or a scrap or getting thrown off of a building or whatever.
But I talked about this in the previous episode. Imagine if the manslaughter line isn't in the trailer. It blows the theater up. If literally, yeah. if he goes, if I kill right. you, we I go to jail. He goes, kill anybody in a fight, you go to jail. It's called manslaughter. Yeah. If that just plays in the movie and you don't see it in the trailer, you go crazy because it's a perfect line. It's a home run. Line.
Yeah.
And then it's a home run when he gets up, when he makes that face kind of like, there's a great thing that Tarantino does understand this. He understands macho, masculinity, toughness, that kind of thing, and also subdued versions of it. Like there's a great, my favorite part of Hateful Eight is Madsen. Michael Madsen has that seething kind of thing that Tarantino's always recognized. Madsen's sitting down, he's writing. Kurt Russell comes in and he's big, swinging his dick around the entire fucking cabin. I'm the rootinest, tootinest. He's doing the Yosemite Sim act. Mm-hmm. He looks over to Madsen, and Madsen's just writing. And Madsen looks up and just kind of smirks at him.
Yeah.
And he goes, what are you doing? And he goes, I'm writing my autobiography. Mm-hmm. Kurt Russell goes, am I in it? And Madsen just smiles. He goes, you just entered. And he's not intimidated by him. He's not worried by him. And it's that seething, I ain't scared of you, motherfucker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Cliff Booth has that in this fucking scene when he says, you know, hey, two out of three, let's do it. And he just goes, and he gets up, he starts taking his jacket off. He takes the fucking wig off.
Yeah.
He's so happy.
Yeah.
That speaks to me and has spoken to me in all of his films, that macho undercurrent. And in Kill Bill, it was flipped on its head because it was a woman who had that fucking macho thing. And it's just, but it's always there, that tough guy, that masculinity, macho-ness.
At the beginning of that scene when he goes, well, I don't want any trouble. Want trouble. That's exactly what you want. That's the opposite of what you want.
Yeah. He can't wait for trouble.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. There's so many moments like that in the movie that I like, that I compare to other moments like... When in Kill Bill, when Beatrix Kiddo goes to Okinawa and she's playing dumb tourist to Hattori Hanzo.
Yep.
And he's playing, I'm just a sushi guy.
Yeah.
They're playing this little thing. And he's like, konnichiwa. And he's yelling at the Charlie Bronson. And, like that thing was all great. It was funny. But then it was like they were both playing a game. And then she's like, this is why I'm here. And then he changes... You hear the Charlie Brown drop something in the background. And that was not a wasted, it was an intentional purpose. One, to show Hitori Hanzo made a vow, I'm never making this weapon of death again. And she's like, actually, you trained this cat, you owe me. And he understands, like, it was so beautifully woven. And there's some little scenes like that. But the problem I had with this movie is all that's leading up to this fictitious ending where the Tates and everybody don't die. And then the graphic violence, I was like, first of all, I've seen this fight scene in Kill Bill. I've seen this graphic violent fight scene.
But not with a dog.
Yeah. I mean, the dog thing where he just, okay, great. And then the flame.
You can't okay great that. Do not dismiss that with just okay great. It's set up an hour and 20 minutes before that with the fucking dog drooling because he's not allowed to eat until he does the fucking noise. It's set up you think it's a cute interplay with him and the dog. And then he's feeding the dog there in the thing, and the dog's waiting to eat. The dog's starving, and then they fucking burst in at the exact wrong time. Just a fucking head move. It's gorgeous. It's a perfect callback. You're waiting. Because you don't see it coming.
Sure. But in the context of this, I'm like, you set this up. And Quentin, there's no way on this earth Quentin Tarantino didn't have approval of his trailer. So you set this trailer up. You can't say the studio cut this. You set this trailer up telling me this is all about Manson family. And oh, my God, we're going to kind of see who was involved in the Manson or whatever, like people around there. There's this one fictional guy that's obviously supposed to be Burt Reynolds or Eastwood or whatever. And then you just go into this when he's beating that girl's head around and then I've seen that fight and I'm just like, this 2 hours and 40 minutes to just go, oh, wouldn't it be great if the hippies got murdered instead?
I just
that's a long you it's I felt like he
that's
was smoking
reductive.
Weed.
I just think that's so reductive to
we don't agree, Mike. You have to accept the fact that I am not going to change my mind on this because he did not make a good movie.
But I can also argue my fucking point.
No,
I totally hear what you're
can't.
Saying.
He
I'm out.
A shitty movie.
I hear what you're saying because, dude, I'm mad. I saw the trailer. The trailer gives me a completely different idea, and that's why it colors my first viewing of the movie. There's no doubt. When I watch it, I'm waiting for different things. And I mean,
I think the trailer would have been better served by avoiding the Manson stuff completely.
Well, but like, we all knew it was the Manson thing because Sharon Tate is in the movie.
Right,
so you know
right.
that that's going to happen.
But they spent so much time when he goes to the ranch, all that time, why won't you show me Shaw? I want to see Shaw. And then just that
no
scene
doubt.
In the bed with fucking
no doubt.
Bruce Dern. I'm like, that was a waste of my time.
All the great tension is great. It doesn't pay off. I agree with you. But then he
and then
gives
Charlie was in Santa Barbara.
He was. And then they give you the epilogue payoff where he makes the guy fix the tire. So you still get your cathartic thing out of it. And then you don't get the text confrontation because Tex is late. But there's no doubt, dude, there's no doubt the Bruce Dern thing is a fizzle. You're just like, this is really?
Yeah.
He makes a John Wilkes Booth thing or whatever the fuck. Like,
right.
Because if you really want to speak to this.
I didn't think he was going to be in there. The way they were setting it up is that he was either dead or they were
of course.
Gone. Yeah.
And then it's just Bruce Dern being Bruce Dern-y. And I'm just like.
But that was supposed to be?
Problem.
That was supposed to be Burt Reynolds before he died.
And then he died. That was Burt Reynolds' role. And then he gave it to Dern. Mm-hmm. But I will say this. I said something about how, you know, Tarantino's not a nostalgic filmmaker. He's a filmmaker who makes his own nostalgia. And so he will bring you a Robert Forster. He brings a Travolta back. He had a Michael Parks for the longest time as part of it. Because that probably would have been a Michael Parks role if, you know, Reynolds had, if he was still alive too. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, Pacino doesn't belong in this fucking movie. There's no reason for Pacino to be that agent guy. Get me a guy from the 70s. Get me a guy I haven't seen in fucking forever. Get me a guy who is in one of those old 50s westerns or something like that. There's no reason for Dern to be in this movie either because he does nothing. It doesn't pay off. I don't think Dern
playing a Jewish agent. I'm like, it's a little weird.
But he doesn't. There's
and
nothing.
It's Pacino
that crackles.
Doing a big Pacino character.
Yeah.
Versus again, like Kill Bill, and I forget the actor's name who plays the sheriff, and then
Michael Parks. So I just said.
That guy, again, because you're like, who is this dude? Where have I seen him? But,
and that's what I mean. He died. So otherwise, he's perfect for the Dern role. You know what I mean? Because he's also in Tarantino's The Gang, which is, as he put in the credits. Mm. By the way, Mattson's in this movie. Not in the credits.
Oh, yeah.
Not even in The Gang. Not even in the listing of the credits. It was bananas. I was like, that's it. Because I looked
for
his name.
Even Tim Roth got in the credits. He wasn't in the movie.
That's what I mean. He gets cut out.
Yeah.
He just put cut.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. But Mattson's in the movie, and he's not in the credits anywhere. So I agree with you that the Dern scene absolutely fizzles because it builds up this. And because up until then, first of all, I don't even know who Margaret Qualley is, but I want to give her all of my money forever. Because
is she the one who played the girl?
She's Pussycat. Oh. Who he picks up at the fucking thing. How sexy and fucking and great. And you can see she's so disappointed because she thinks that he's perfect for the family. He's like, Charlie's going to love you. She really means that. She's not trying to bamboozle him. And then he kind of betrays her. And there's this whole sub thing, too. Let's get into this.
By the way, I'll say this. That was, again, it was a great showing, the family's nuts. And this is how really creepy they are, knowing historically how creepy they were. When he's, cute girl on the ranch. And then he's like, this ain't right.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this is awesome. And then there's no payoff. I'm like, what is the purpose of this?
Not only is there no payoff there, but I think this was a conscious choice that he made as well. We see how incredibly creepy and weird they are on Spahn Ranch. Okay. But their whole approach to the fucking final murders is fucking Three Stooges.
I know.
I think this is done on purpose. The Manson family is this, because again, just the name, the Manson family inspires dread. It is this, holy shit, there's this legacy of murder and death.
And they weren't trained killers. These were just basically
they fell under the sway of a guy.
Yeah, they're basically brainwashed.
They did a lot of LSD.
Yeah. And they did terrible things. They came to do the devil's business. That's all real stuff. But then I think he purposely neuters them in the movie to make them not scary anymore. Like, I think it's a choice he makes because that one girl flees in the car and then in a chicken shit way. And that one girl, I don't know how that even stayed in the movie, the cut of her giving the, we've been taught to murder by people TV. So,
the speech. Yeah.
Well, it's delivered so fucking bad. I mean, where she's just like, okay, man, I've been thinking. And I'm like, that got through your cut? I mean, because it's awful. It's a really over the top, weird delivery of what you would think a hippie would sound like. Mm-hmm. And that's why I went, is this, so now is he purposely making them less scary? Like, because Tex Watson, again, that's a scary fucking name. The Manson family, scary. They were always these boogeymen. And in this movie, you see him, he's physically shaking. I'm surprised he didn't piss himself when he confronts fucking Brad Pitt. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we see they all get fucking massacred.
Right.
And they don't even put up a fucking fight, essentially. So it's like he strips the Manson family of all their mystique to show them for what they were. A bunch of fucking barefoot, dirty fucking hippies who, if they'd run into the wrong fucking people, they would have never been infamous.
Right.
And I think that's a choice that he made. You know, I
and also the gullibility of being taken in by ultimately a cult leader.
But also there's that theme, and which is, again, I just said you can't view the movie through the prism of today. But this weird thing where it's almost like he's relitigating the late 60s and thinking, hey, were the hippies wrong? Because how many times we hear dirty hippies, filthy hippies, fucking hippies, and they're inevitably the villains in the movie, and the straight, you know, which is also a commentary on the fact that, you know, black and white always win. You know, in the black and white shows, good and evil, good wins, evil loses.
You're the heavy. You're gonna lose.
All
today.
That theme runs throughout, yeah. And it's rampant. Yes. And at the end, it's flipped on its face because who we consider the heavies, the conservatives, the boozers, the fucking, man, these hippie dickbags, because we've been taught forever that the hippies are counterculture and they changed everything. And his way to look at it here is, well, was that a good thing?
Well, it's...
What if the hippies instead were defeated, essentially? You know what I mean? As if they and he makes the conservative guys the winner. Even the cops, they're laughing with cops and firemen. The devil's business or devil shit or whatever. They're laughing at hippies, at counterculture.
Well, it's a reinterpretation of a moment in time.
Yeah.
When you look at it. But also, what's really important about it is this was a very important moment in time culturally after these murders. Hollywood changed, the country changed, the way we looked at hippies in the 60s all changed when these things happened. So I think it's interesting to see a reimagining and a reinterpretation of those events, because now with his events where, you know, the hippies basically were stopped from doing these horrible murders, how would the culture in the country change? Would we have seen more Sharon Tate movies? Like in this universe, mm-hmm. what happens next, right, after this?
Does Roman Polanski's kid... Does Roman Polanski not get drunk and high and rape a teenage girl? You know what I mean? Does
that work? What happens in this alternate universe, this Earth 2?
Yeah, you know? I mean, like...
And I think he very clearly wants that to be the discussion, mm-hmm. you know?
The actual Manson family did is it showed this, like, all the hippies... are like, no, we're all not the same. There's some of us that are all about peace and love. And the radicals went too far. I mean, there was the early hippies were actually radicals and they wanted to invoke change. And then, and this is a lot of it was by design. Then a lot of drugs got infused in it to make it more about just this love and sex.
The lifestyle.
Know? The lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So you got to understand. So there's all these separate
free
tracks.
Free love.
You know, just tune in, tune out. You know what I mean? That whole thing. I mean, Woodstock happened this summer.
Yes.
Summer of 69. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Woodstock was free and love and, mm-hmm. hey, man, everyone's cool and working
and
together.
Never happened again.
And never happened again.
And then this happened.
Right. And that theme is prevalent in this movie in that, you know, DiCaprio is clearly the straight-laced conservative... he's the old generation. And then there's the hippies, the filthy, dirty Manson family and dumpster diving and dirty feet and all that. Mm-hmm. And then you got Cliff Booth, who's comfortable in both worlds.
He doesn't even know what he wants at one point.
Until he's not.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then when he's confronted with the actual hippies and stuff at Spahn Ranch, he reverts to being, hey, I worked here 8 years ago and I know George and he's a friend and you guys are taking advantage of, like, he's the moral center of the film. But he's in the center of the Venn diagram of the hippies and the conservatives. Like, right. Cliff Booth is just, you know, he lives his own moral code. He might have killed his wife. He's a war hero. He's all these different things. And I think he is us. That's who we're supposed to identify with in the movie. You know, because DiCaprio, he didn't know what the fuck he's doing. He's a drunk. And also, there's another great line. DiCaprio's drinking and he goes, my booze don't need nobody. So... the older squares were just booze. No drugs. No thanks.
And it's also...
But Pitt buys the LSD cigarette. Yeah, what the fuck? Yeah, why not, man? We'll see how that goes.
I'll save it for later.
Yeah.
And also, DiCaprio's character is portrayed as this tough guy, but he's crying. He's an insecure actor.
And it also, what I do love about it is even back then, it shows how fragile these careers all were.
Sure.
Like, you know, a couple of mistakes and, you know, you go to the back of the line again. And... it also showed, which is interesting, that, you know, it's hard to imagine now that, you know, TV was like the medium that the film actors would like look down upon.
Oh,
now,
sure.
I mean, now we're in a golden age of
television.
You're
stuck in TV now. That was the thinking into the 90s.
Yeah.
And that's
why
the speech by Pacino, whether he belongs in the movie or not, is so great. It's reminiscent of the "This is how Superman sees us" speech that Carradine gives in Kill Bill 2. Hey, man, the heavy gets his ass beat every week. Like, who's going to beat you next week? The man from Uncle?
Yeah.
The girl from Uncle? Mm-hmm. Batman? Bam. Mm-hmm. Zoom. Mm-hmm. And he's laughing in DiCaprio's face, but he's trying to get him to understand, hey, man, there's another world of opportunity out there. But he brings him, and DiCaprio, of course, because he's been conditioned to think TV is that's, you know, he's fine with it. That's where he made his bones. He can't go to Italy and leave America and go make movies over there. That's garbage. Why would I fucking do that? So he just hears he's a has-been. His career's over.
And I love how they, like, marginalized, like, Sergio Leone. I'm like, yo, that hack over in Italy. Yep. Sergio Leone, like, he's terrible. You can't be in one of his movies. They're cookie cutter.
Well, it shows a lot of things, that the historical reference point of that's probably what those movies were looked at back then.
Sure.
And then they became masterpieces. It was like people told Shatner, he was a Shakespearean actor out of Canada, you sure you want to do sci-fi? That's the end of the road, buddy. Sci-fi is the end of the road. He did a TV series for 3 seasons. It got canceled. It's like, we told you.
Yeah.
Now you're just known as this joke guy doing this Kirk thing.
Where are you going to go from here?
Where are you going to go from here? You know? And so all that stuff is interesting. But as you said in the regular episode, Mike, it's an hour and 45 minutes of interesting. There's another hour that I don't need. And then I at the ending.
But that's me and you. I'm willing to give a guy whose work I've admired forever and I consider a revolutionary in this business, in this industry, and in the way I look at this medium, I'm giving him that other hour to live in.
I got to tell you, normally I don't have the patience for that second hour. I'm the first one to say something is too long or like this could be good, but this is the one exception where I just kind of let the whole thing wash over me and the length didn't bother me. But I have to say it's more the exception to the rule for me.
I agree, because I said the first time, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
What I was going to say is normally iconic filmmakers like this, I'll say, look, even when they swing and miss, I like it. It's interesting. This felt arrogant and didn't care about its audience. It felt like I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want because I'm Tarantino. And
but that element is in all of his films. It's just it didn't land this time because I'm not going to argue again. I don't need another camera angle that starts at somebody's ankles. I don't. I understand. I don't need a camera in the backseat of every fucking car. I don't. I get it. And some of it, like I said, played. He steers completely into the skid of the foot fetish thing. I understand where everything you're saying. I'm not disagreeing with.
I think the one I can explain, the one I can't. The foot fetish, no. But the camera in the backseat of every car was to put the viewer into the period that this was being shot. I really felt like that was.
But by the sixth car or whatever, I just don't need it. I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. He wanted to make sure that the audience was a passenger in every single car, and that's why he put it in every single.
And
one.
That's weird filmmaking trick.
Yeah.
To me, that's like you talk about his angles and his creativity and stuff. That's because if you go to it three times in within a half hour,
right,
in three different vehicles and stuff.
It's I agree. Like, I'm done after that. I'm like,
it feels like a different approach versus. I want to do this really interesting thing. I want to tell the story my way versus I'm Tarantino. I can do whatever I want.
Boy, are you clouded by how you feel about him? Maybe because we have another mutual friend who literally texted me and he's like, this was just, I'm so cool and I can do Tarantino things and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't.
Because the things didn't connect. There was too many scenes that were interesting there, but then there was all these other things that didn't connect. In the past, he takes his time and go very methodically, and it's for a bigger purpose. Where these didn't connect for me. It was just like, oh, here's a long shot because I put in long shots. Like I feel like I've seen other filmmakers do this, and I feel like he is running out of tricks, and so he's leaning in the same ones.
I can't stress enough. Especially upon the second viewing, I love this movie. But I recognize it's flawed. Because I've run into a bit of a thing now, certainly for me getting older. Because I loved Mandy. All right, if we're going to talk about something. I loved the movie Mandy. And I told everybody, but I prefaced it. I go, look, you're probably going to hate it. Like, you may not enjoy it. But for me, it was a wheelhouse movie. Yeah. I fucking loved it. Again, swing for the fucking fences. And then I have heard nothing but an avalanche of, Jesus, that sucked. I couldn't even get through it. It was terrible. And I'm like, that's fine. And I laugh.
I felt like I was watching Night Gallery.
For Mandy?
No, for this movie.
Oh, for this movie? I can see what you're saying. Again, because there are things that are of a piece that you take them out. Absolutely. The transition into the third act when they come back from Italy. I don't care for the narrator. All right. I understand that to me is a trick that I don't know why he's fucking using it.
And he didn't use it through the whole movie. Like it just kind of appeared.
But he's been doing that. And in Hateful Eight, all of a sudden a narrator fucking pops up at the end of the goddamn intermission. And you're like, what the fuck are you doing?
And
man?
I didn't think that was necessary either.
But at least he didn't use his own fucking voice this time. He at least used Kurt Russell, which is also a weird choice because he's in the fucking movie.
Yeah.
But you're like, is this the stunt guy from Green Hornet doing the narration now? Why are you doing, you know what I mean? It's just, he's, to your point, he's going to do what the fuck he wants. But I'm cool with that. I will let him do what he wants. But that transition, when they use Out of Time by the Stones, when they're coming back on the plane from Italy, and the music, it gets you to the El Coyote. It's so gorgeous. It's just so, that's a 5-minute gorgeous fucking chunk where they're, you know, he's pondering in first class. He's pondering in coach. Sharon is pregnant. I read some people had some real problems with the narration, like at El Coyote, when he said she was feeling especially warm and pregnant in all the worst ways. And there are people who are like, how do you know that? Why is he making that presumption? Why? And it's like, dude, because this is his interpretation of the fucking movie and the world. That's why. You either live with it or you don't. And that's...
Well, there's a little bit of trivia there, too. As the Tate party enters the El Coyote restaurant, still there, by the way, and horrible food, by the way. And
those green tamales are good.
Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring discuss a movie premiere they can see taking place further down Beverly Boulevard, an erotic movie theater. They have premieres for dirty movies, asked Sharon. The theater is the Eros, a real adult theater of the time. The building still exists, but is now the cinema called the New Beverly, which is owned by
Quentin Tarantino. Yeah, that's awesome.
When I first moved here, I used to go to the New Beverly
all the time.
It was the greatest thing to see.
Double features, horrible, uncomfortable seats, but you didn't care.
You didn't care. And you saw all these amazing movies on the big screen for the first. Some of them were movies I had already seen on VHS, but I was like, I got to see it on the big screen. I saw Serpico there.
And this is why I give him all the rope to hang me off a cliff, man. The guy loves movies. He loves movie making. And if he's indulgent, huh?
Remember in Swingers when they had like, there was the New Beverly schedule was on every fridge.
it's, this was his version. This was his of a 70s sprawling, like even to the point where Out of Time, which I've just talked about with by the Stones, that's the song over the closing credits of Coming Home. And I forever associate it with, cause that, and Dern's in that, you know, Dern, that last half hour of Coming Home, you want to ruin your life. Watch the last half hour of Coming Home. Jesus Christ. It's powerful. But again, I hear that song and it brings me to that era. It brings me to, you know, to 78, even though this is 69, all of a sudden I'm like, well, I'm back in 78. It's Coming Home and there's Dern and I see Dern. And I mean,
it was a great soundtrack too.
Oh my God. It's if you listen to it, if you sit, cause that's all I've been listening to for 3 days and it's, Because I will tell you this, Mrs. Robinson is in it too, which is The Graduate. That's 67.
Yep.
That brings me right fucking there. But it's playing on the AM radio when he's driving, and that's when he sees the girl at the bus stop. And again, this is just an inside for anybody. There's when Pitt finally gets to talk to the hitchhiker, and he goes, "You sit on Burbank Boulevard this whole day trying to get tourists to take you up and down to Spahn Ranch," and then he then leaves Burbank Boulevard and gets on the 101 at Hollywood. And you're just like, all right, well, that's not exactly really, they're not even equidistant from one another for fuck's sake. But he is filming that on Burbank Boulevard because in the background is a bar that clearly there's a bar on Burbank Boulevard that I recognized.
No one was flipping through an old Thomas guide.
Yeah. and then sure enough, he gets on the 101 at Hollywood by the Hollywood Adventist. It made me laugh. But Los Angeles looks so beautiful in this movie.
That's where the nostalgia kicks in.
It's a love letter to a place and a time. Yeah. You know, and a time that he wishes he could have experienced. He'll give you some bullshit, but he was 6 years old. He doesn't remember the fucking
No, of course not. I mean, and it goes like, oh, Musso and Franks, like stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, people, you know, because we've been around for so long.
He made sure to have the scene with Pacino on the phone and in the background when he did the flambe, you know, to make sure you got to catch that if you're going to do Musso and Franks.
Right.
As a filmmaker, I just, again, you are both filmmakers. And I think, Chris, you're giving it more, you were willing to indulge and let it wash over you in a way.
Yes.
And you want a cleaner storytelling.
Yeah,
you
wanted, because, and I get that. And I feel like anytime I, as the audience, feel like I'm being taken granted, like,
sure,
I'm great. You'll just have to listen to this. It's like watching some musician on stage being an asshole and you're like, man, I don't care how many fucking gold records you have.
Dude, I hear you. I mean, there's the scene where, again, the narrator is giving the speech about the Italian Westerns. And you get we get all the fun posters of the Italian mm-hmm. Westerns that he made. But then he also discusses the Tower of Babel, where everybody spoke their own. And I'm like, nobody gives a fuck about that in Iowa, dude. Nobody gives a shit about the Tower of Babel way to make films in Italian, no. where everybody spoke their own language. But it made me laugh. I was just, and also because there's that, even like, again, that scene with the little girl when he first meets her. And then he's on the verge of falling apart any moment because he realizes his career is almost over. And then he's reading the book and then he relates it. And we all get it. Even the 8-year-old isn't really picking it up until he starts crying. And then she right. gets it. And then that's Tarantino speaking through the DiCaprio character, in my opinion, of the fading of masculinity, the fading of feeling useless mm-hmm. and letting it go day by day. And it might even be a commentary on how he felt in writing and making this movie. Maybe he doesn't have the chops he had with Pulp Fiction and he had to work. Maybe that's the reason this took 5 fucking years.
Or, yeah, you feel as you get older.
He used to be able to bang something out.
Yeah, as you get older, you feel less and less relevant.
Yeah.
As an artist.
And he's got to be thinking, because I will tell you this, man, I just read, he did a thing, I think it was about Viva Zapata, I forget. He writes for the New Beverly site. And I read it and I'm like, this is his life. If he ever stops just making films, just write these treatises, these long fucking blogs about these movies that he loves, because you can see how clearly he loves them. Mm-hmm. And I think to make something like this shows, you say laziness or indulgence, and I felt that the first time I saw it. But then the second time I saw it, I went, this guy loves this. I've often said, if you're a rock star, why would you ever quit? People always beef, they're like Cheap Trick's at the local fair. Ha ha, Cheap Trick's playing Summerfest or Ribfest. Well, yeah, but they're still making $10,000 for an hour and 15 minutes of work. And then they go to the next town and you're a rock star. Why would you ever quit? If you're Tarantino.
And they still love it.
Right? Mm-hmm. And he loves movies and he loves movie making. And it might be a harder process for him now. And he might not have he's the lion and winner. He doesn't edit like he used to. He doesn't bang bang it. It's not as slick. But he probably feels that he has every idea is a good one and he just fucking jam-packs the shit out of a movie that's 2 hours and 40 minutes that could be 2 hours. Clearly, I agree with you.
And, also as a director, there's not that many directors that can get multiple A-list actors in one movie the way he can.
They line up. They want to do it. And even, because I'll say this too. For me, this is a dirty secret. I don't fucking know why Sharon Tate's in this movie. I get it. It's because you wanted to frame it with the Manson murders. And he himself felt it was important to reframe her in the way everybody saw her, as a fresh-faced, brilliant starlet who had so much potential, instead of just being known as a footnote in the Manson murders.
Right. Well, that's part of the thing, too, is like he brings up the opening party at the Playboy Mansion. He does this thing of there's Michelle Williams and all these key people. So he's trying to say, oh, this is a real, yeah. this is the time.
And then Mama Cass runs up.
Yeah, Cass runs up. There's Steve McQueen.
Steve McQueen talking shit. Oh, hilarious.
And he gives the storyline of
J.C. Bring and, yeah. and the three-way, Polanski, Sebring, mm-hmm. and Tate.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, cool. And then
we leave. We're at the Playboy Mansion for 4 minutes, if that. And all of it's a dance scene. They're dancing. We only get McQueen mm-hmm. talking to who I thought was Joey Heatherton, but was never identified. And also, I'll tell you this. When she says Sharon Tate has a type, brilliant, smart little boys who brilliant, smart men who look like 12-year-old boys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was waiting. That's on a T for an Ally McGraw joke. I'm like, how the fuck is McQueen not doing an Ally McGraw joke?
I know.
Hey, you know, like, well, there's some appeal to that. You know what I mean? Like, if you know, because you know the history, you know Ally McGraw, you're like, yeah. I mean, you want to talk about someone who dated someone who looked like 12-year-old boys, McQueen and Ally McGraw, boom. Mm-hmm. But then McQueen gets the line that, you know, I never had a chance. Like, he wanted to rail Sharon Tate. And you're like, right. All right, yeah. But I still think the McGraw line would be more interesting. But you're right. If you're going to the Playboy Mansion, give me a whole fucking interlude. Give me 10 minutes there or 15 where you're talking to people or, you know, because Mama Cass isn't even identified. I think she calls her mama when she runs up and hugs her.
It's obvious. You saw her. I was like, oh, there's Mama Cass.
Yeah, yeah. I am not arguing with your point, because the first time I saw it, I walked out and I told people, I go, it's really good, but man, I got issues with it. And I did. But then the second time I see it, I enjoy what he's done enough and I trust him enough and I'm willing to recognize, oh my goodness. Yes. Yeah. And I think he didn't do it to be, I'm cool, I'm this, I'm that. He loves what he does. And maybe he can't control it and he puts out 2 hours and 40 minutes instead. Because again, we don't need a whole Lancer. We don't need him eating it. You know, I mean, we get it with the chicken leg, the affectation, and then the beans and the Jim Stacy, and then going to one. But he loves making films and showing you how they're made. So they go to one. They move the camera all the way behind Jim Stacy. We see him running lines with an old school tape recorder in the pool and then in the funk and mad at himself because he has to call for. They show you how TV works. Line. And it's because it was being filmed to tape back then. Yeah. You're learning. In addition to experiencing it, he's bringing you what he loves, and he's showing you this and this and this. For me, so. I the second time around, like I said, the first time around, I really dug it, but I was also like, man, I got a ton of issues with this, and all of them are what you have. But then the second time I saw it, I went, I'm, this was his sprawling 70s movie he didn't get to make.
All right,
I'm not
gents.
Giving him another 2.5 hours
in my life. We, before we forget.
I'm turning 50 on Monday. He doesn't get another fucking 3 hours of my life.
We, happy pre-birthday,
thanks.
By the way.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And we have some Patreon sponsors for this episode. Don't want to forget them before we finish. Mike, would you care to do a couple of them again?
I'd love to. Are they the ones from the... From,
yep.
They are remarkably similar.
All right, well, how about if I read the ones that I didn't get to read the last time?
Done.
All right. Johnny Rulon, he's promoting his novel titled Green Cheek, A Junkie's Guide to Street Magic, and it is available on Amazon in both digital form and hard copy. It is an experimental stream of consciousness novel which follows the exploits of the muse Calliope and her immortal lover T.S. They're on a journey through time, dreams, and the hidden places of a supernatural America. The website is happyhorrorshowproductions.com. That's happyhorrorshowproductions.com.
Fanboy Planet, a website and podcast for all things geeky and amazing. Check out Fanboy Planet for your comics news, movie news, TV news, and amazing interviews with industry insiders and artists. Fanboyplanet.com. And from Chris Parker Howard, Coffee Over Suicide, a dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. New episodes every Friday wherever podcasts are found. Find out more at coffeeoversuicide.com.
Our good friend, the immensely talented Alice Fraser, co-host of the Bugle podcast, host of Tea with Alice podcast, brings you a series of three genre-bending solo stand-up shows that explore the boundary between comedy and tragedy. The shows were recorded back-to-back as a three-hour show at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival in April 2018, and she used a binaural microphone, which creates an intensely immersive listening experience. Find out more at alicefraser.com. That's with an S, alicefraser.com.
And the Art Podcast with Rebecca Evans. When we move past hesitation and we're true to ourselves, we'll find our own art in life. New episode with artist Mickey Caputo. The Art Podcasts with an S. TheArtPodcasts.com.
Aussie Noir. I can take this one. Why not?
No, take it.
I did it last time, too. I'm happy to do it. No, I didn't. You did. Aussie Noir. The murder of Jeremy Brooks. The police say it was a mugging gone bad. She thinks it was a target attack. More info at TonyMcFadden.net/JB. TonyMcFadden.net/JB. Tony Mac.
Boom. Thank you so much, Patreon supporters. We appreciate it very, very much. You want your ad read? 50 beans? Oh, get it done. Every episode for the month. So, any closing thoughts?
I'm laughing because there's a monitor in here that you guys don't know about on the wall. And we have the Manson Wikipedia page up, and it's got that headshot of Manson that we always see.
With the crazy eyes.
And Graham's been staring at it for like all through the plugs. He literally was staring the whole time. And I'm like, oh no, he's falling sway. Oh, that's not good. But yeah, final thoughts. You know my final thoughts. There's no reason. I was talking to Bobby G. We were texting back and forth, and he thinks Pulp and Dogs are like his masterpieces. And I said, I think he's made 7 masterpieces. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, and this, they are all of a piece of Los Angeles. And he as Scorsese is to New York, he is to Los Angeles. He sees this place like nobody ever has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoyed this film. I thought I was able to look over the flaws because, like I said, I let it just kind of wash over me as a fable of Los Angeles and these historic events. But in the back of my head, I was definitely thinking some people may not be enjoying this as well.
As I said, I agree.
I'm done talking about it.
What the?
Mike Schmidt, where can people find you on the World Wide Web?
You know, you can get me at mike@mikeschmidtcomedy.com. You can be my friend at facebook.com/the40-year-old boy. You can follow me at twitter.com/the40-year-old boy. I'm available on Instagram and Snapchat at Mike40YOB. I'm also available on the PS4 network at Mike40YOB. You can subscribe to me at youtube.com/the40yearoldboy. It's got all 11 years of the podcast archived there for you to check out, along with some stand-up and some soon-to-be Twitch clips. Those will be there. What's that, Twitch clips? Well, of course. I'm at twitch.tv/the40yearoldboy, playing video games and yelling into a microphone. Come and visit and watch me do that.
Twitch clips.
All my tour dates are at grahamelwood.com. Check that out and buy some stuff in the store, because we're shutting it down. So get your merch now. Before
everything must go.
Everything must go.
So Thrilling Adventure Hour. Well, it depends on when this is going to drop.
It
may already be done. You may not even know. But like we said, spend $20. And if you want to be a Patreon subscriber, people are grabbing the loot crate. You have to be a Patreon subscriber for 2 months, and then we will send out a loot crate. A lot of cool stuff in there for sure. Everything from Doug Benson CDs to Dean Haglund trading cards we have in the garage that could be yours. So, all right. That is our episode. That is Spoiler Ep 98, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
That's all it. Right. Thanks, Mike Schmidt.
We doing this again in 5 years?
Of course.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's when he makes his movie. What, once every five? Yeah.
About that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll do this in 5 years. We'll be celebrating episode 800. I don't know what we say next. Oh, yeah, Aaron Brungart, everybody at All Things Comedy, thank you so much. My name is Graham Elwood.
And I'm Chris Mancini. And as always, remember, Han shot first. Twitch clips.
That's not a thing.
It actually is, sadly.